Thanks for joining us today on our study over the intertestamental period. My name is Tom Rowe, and I'll be your guide over the next several sessions as we take a look at the period in between the close of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. This study began with a discussion between Clay and I as our men's Bible study was moving from the Old Testament to the New Testament. We had spent 3 years going through chapter by chapter the Old Testament, and we felt like we really wanted to do something that bridged this period to the New Testament. We identified 3 goals for this study. First of all, we wanted to explicitly fill what is in most people's minds kind of a black hole, and that is the 400 years of this period. A lot of this information, the kings, the ideas will be new for you, and that's very exciting. I'm glad to be a part of that. Our second goal was to illuminate this period by using the original sources and exposing our listeners to the actual writers of this period. There was a huge flourishing of literature in the intertestamental with many writers who had many different perspectives and loyalties. Now, not everyone had access to all of these writers. It would have been very unlikely that, say, a Jewish peasant farmer in Judea would read the highly educated Jewish writer Philo of Alexandria. So we're very fortunate that we do get to read these diverse sources and perspectives. Our third goal for this study was to tie the intertestamental to the New Testament. We explicitly wanted to relate what we studied to the New Testament and show how this period influenced various thoughts and ideas within the New Testament. So to that aim, I do include sections in the study that draw out those connections. So let's talk a little bit in general about the intertestamental period. We're talking about a period that runs from the 5th century BCE up until the 1st century CE. Judaism in this period is referred to as Hellenistic Judaism. That would be in contrast to First Temple Judaism, which is the Judaism during the monarchy before the exile, and Rabbinic Judaism, which is the Judaism that developed after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 CE. Although we often see first century Judaism today as a single monolithic religion, what we're going to find out through this study is that it was actually very diverse in terms of belief, geography, and political association. So this is a study that might challenge some of your preconceptions about Judaism. As an example, we often hear in the church today that Judaism is a religion focused on legalism. The idea being that to be a good Jew and go to heaven in the first century, you would need to do all the sacrifices, you would need to fulfill the requirements of the law, and by doing so, you would earn your way to salvation. What we'll find out through this study is that that is a complete misrepresentation of Judaism in the intertestamental period. That interpretation really dates back to the Protestant reformers of the 16th century and has largely been debunked by modern scholars. So that being said, if I step on your toes, I apologize, but I encourage you to stick with it because I think it'll be beneficial. And my contact info is included, so if you have further questions, definitely give me a call. I would love to hear your questions and have a discussion with you. I've also included the slide presentations for download on the website, and I would encourage you to follow along with them. There are great maps in there we'll be referring to, and of course, the outline of the discussion itself. As a side note, I do follow the modern scholarly convention of using BCE before the Common Era and CE, the Common Era, instead of the more traditional BC and AD. It's not a political or religious statement in doing that. That's just the way that modern scholars talk about time periods, and I'm following that particular methodology. So let's begin by talking about why studying the intertestamental period would be important. Why spend several hours listening to someone like me drone on and on and on about the minutiae of the intertestamental period? Well, here are three reasons why it's important. First of all, 400 years is a long, long time. A lot can happen. Imagine the difference between the pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock and today in America. A lot has happened. By skipping over the intertestamental period, we're skipping over about that same amount of time of American history. Allow me to give you an analogy. Most of us are probably familiar with the three original Star Wars films. Imagine if someone watched the first film, skipped the second, and then watched the third. They would have several questions of importance for the storyline. Who is this creature Yoda who's green, and why is he suddenly an expert on the Force? What happened to Han Solo, and why is he encased in carbonite? And probably the biggest question of all, why does Luke Skywalker call Darth Vader his father? So we're up for that type of confusion if we skip over the intertestamental period and going from the Old Testament to the New Testament. A second reason we want to study this period is that there were major challenges to Judaism as well as changes in the world. Here are a few. There were new groups like the Pharisees that appeared during this period. We see the Pharisees in the Gospels, so it might be important to understand where they came from. We also saw new kingdoms rise and fall during the intertestamental period. There was a Jewish kingdom in Judea in the 2nd century BCE that was then supplanted by the Romans. Well, it might be important to understand how that happened so that we understand what people of the 1st century CE were thinking about the Romans. Third, there were a lot of new ideas that developed during the intertestamental period, such as the idea of life after death. A lot of this theological creativity was in response to the changing political, cultural, and religious changes. And some of these ideas are picked up in the New Testament. Obviously, life and resurrection after death was picked up by the New Testament writers. A third reason we want to study this period is because it is the lens through which the New Testament writers look back at the Old Testament. The New Testament writers saw the Old Testament through the questions that surrounded their daily lives. Here's an example. The New Testament writers didn't quote the Hebrew Old Testament in the Gospels. They quoted what is called the Septuagint. That is the Greek language translation of the Old Testament. Well, the Septuagint was written during the intertestamental period. So we might want to understand, why was it written? What was the impetus from that? Jewish writers as well reinterpreted the Old Testament through the lens of the questions in front of them. Let me give you an example. In Numbers 23, we have the story of Balaam. Balaam was a priest that was hired by another king to curse the Israelites. So in this story, Balaam goes up and he's getting ready to curse the Israelites, but instead, when he opens his mouth, he doesn't curse them. He blesses them. God causes him to bless the Israelites. And here's part of how it's put in Numbers 23:9. Balaam says, "As I see them from the mountaintops, gaze on them from the heights, there is a people that dwells apart, not reckoned among the nations." Well, obviously, we know in the Old Testament, the Israelites are seen as a different people from other nations. And that is because they are God's covenant people. God has a special relationship. He has chosen the Israelites to be the conduit of his love and truth in the world. Philo of Alexandria retells this story, but he makes some additions that reflect the concerns and ideas of the first century. Philo was a Jew living in Alexandria. He came from a rich family. He was very Hellenized. His brother was actually an Egyptian high official. So the way that Philo retells the same story is very interesting. Here's what he says. "For I shall behold them with my eyes from the loftiest mountains, and I shall see them with my mind, and I shall never be able to injure the people which shall dwell alone, not being numbered among the other nations, not in accordance with the inheritance of any particular place or any apportionment of lands, but by reason of the peculiar nature of their remarkable customs, as they will never mingle with any other nation so as to depart from their national and ancestral ways." So, two things stick out about the way Philo tells this story. First of all, the focus of the promise of Abraham is not on a particular land. That might be surprising unless we take into effect that Philo was part of what we call the diaspora, Jews living abroad in the Mediterranean world. He lived in Egypt. Obviously, if his brother was an Egyptian government official, they did pretty well. So from Philo's perspective, it wouldn't really make sense for him to say to be a good Jew and to be faithful to God's calling, you have to live in Judea, in the promised land. The other thing that he changes or adds is this idea of national customs, ancestral ways. The reason they are a people apart is because they keep these customs. In sections 3 and 4 of our study, we're going to talk about what were these customs. How did they define what it meant to be Jewish? So today, we're going to talk a little bit about the structure of this study. There's a lot of information, obviously, about this period. So I have broken it down in 3 different areas: the political, the cultural, and the religious aspects of the intertestamental period. Now, these are artificial categories, modern constructs, if you will, just for the sake of our ease of learning. The inhabitants of this period would not have separated the world through these lenses. The political was the religious, was the cultural. Everything was intertwined, and we'll see that during our study. So during the political section, we're going to talk about the new ways of understanding Yahweh's reign over the Jewish people and, in reality, the world. In the cultural section, we'll talk about this new impulse of Hellenism and how it affected Jewish identity. And then lastly, in the religious section, We're going to talk about different beliefs that developed during this period, as well as different groups within Judaism that sprang up. And as I promised, we will also tie these back to the New Testament throughout our study. So let's talk about these political challenges. What you see in the intertestamental period happening is that the loss of local political control and independent nationhood caused a reevaluation of what it meant to worship Yahweh and to live, as Balaam says, the people that dwells apart. Here's a couple examples. If you live 2,000 miles away from Jerusalem and Rome, how can you make a trip to Jerusalem 3 times a year like the Old Testament talks about? If you're a soldier in an army, how is it possible for you to keep the Sabbath? Do you go to your captain and say, hey, it's Saturday, it's the Sabbath, so I'm not going to march today? I'm not going to fight a war today? So different groups within Hellenistic Judaism had to create ways to explain, minimize, or get around these challenges. The transition from detached, distant rulers to localized foreign rulers, and I put that in quotation marks, spurred new thinking about what it meant to be Yahweh's special people in a Gentile world. The Persians, as we'll find out, were pretty hands-off. Some of the other rulers that followed, not so much. The actions of these rulers really created pressure points within Hellenistic Judaism. Some of these points helped soothe some groups, other points antagonized groups. And again, there were multiple groups in Judaism, so what worked for one didn't necessarily work for the others. Our focus specifically today will be on two periods. The Persian period up to the conquering of Alexander the Great. That's the late 6th century to about 323 BCE. And then the Ptolemaic period up to the Maccabean Revolt. So that's about 323 BCE to 167 BCE. So let's talk about what happened after the Babylonian exile. The exile ends with the Persians in control. I've given you a map that shows the Persian Empire at the height of its power, about 500 BCE. There are two kings pictured here. One is Cyrus the Great, who we will talk about presently, and another one, Darius the First. He was the king at the time of the greatest expansion of the Persian Empire. So Cyrus the Great. Unlike the Assyrians and Babylonians, Cyrus seemed to believe in the right of conquered peoples to worship as they wished and respected their rights in some forms. He didn't deport entire populations that he took over, such as others had done before him, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and such. So in 538 BC, Cyrus the Great issues the famous Edict of Restoration, and you can find that in the book of Ezra. This edict allows the exiles to return to Judah and begin to rebuild. However, relatively few of the exiles in Babylon or other places actually did return. By this time, there were Jewish communities all throughout the Mediterranean and the Assyrian Empire. And I think a reason is that the exiles had followed the command of the prophets. They had been told, when you go to Babylon, marry, create jobs, create families, settle down, live your life. So not many came back. The Persians did take several steps to manage their domain efficiently. They did appoint local governors. Nehemiah, who has a book in the Old Testament, was one of these local governors. They levied taxes on the populace, Everybody did that, so not really a surprise there. They provided for a military defense. There was a Persian army that would defend them if another nation attacked. There was a court system so that rather than resorting to violence, local rulers could appeal to a higher authority and solve their issues. And then they also allowed for freedom of worship. As we discussed, Cyrus allowed the temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. And for this, he is actually given a title in Ezra, and that title is Messiah, the Anointed One. However, not everything is completely good and hunky-dory, if you will, in the Persian period. We do see tensions arising around life as a Jewish minority in a larger Gentile world. For example, Ezra ends with the story of the purging of foreign wives and children. Any Jewish male who had foreign wives and children had to send them away, kick them out of their house. The entire book of Daniel also centers around this message of ethnic and religious purity. Think about the stories that are in Daniel. The first story, don't eat unclean food. Don't worship idols, even under the threat of death. Even the apocalyptic sections, first and foremost, communicate the idea that God will overturn the current political order and restore the Jews to supremacy. So these are obviously different concerns from the pre-exilic monarchy period when Solomon ruled over the entire nation, as well as some of the nations around them, and sort of made the rules. But this question of how to live in a Gentile world dominated the literature and the thoughts of the intertestamental period. And we'll talk further about that. So the Persians remain in control until a great leader comes on them from the west. And that leader is Alexander of Macedonia, or as we call him today, Alexander the Great. He's often thought as being Greek, but he's actually from Macedonia. He succeeded his father Philip about 335 or 334 BCE, and he immediately began conquering the known world. Interestingly enough, his teacher was the philosopher Aristotle. And Alexander said of Aristotle that he was indebted to his father Philip for living, but to his teacher Aristotle for living well. So from 334 to 323, Alexander conquers the Mediterranean basin from Greece to Egypt. He goes through Syria, modern-day Iran, even into India. The only reason he turns back is because his soldiers revolt after being on the campaign for 11 years. Now, more important than his armies and unifying this huge area under a centralized ruler was what else he brought with his armies, and that is the culture of Hellenism. This is a cultural outlook and really a force that forces Jews in the intertestamental period to more definitively think about what it means to be Jewish. And we'll talk about Hellenism in podcast 3 and 4. So after 11 years, like a candle being burned on both ends, Alexander goes out and dies in 323. His lands are then split up between his generals. Judea itself falls to the leader of Egypt, Ptolemy I. Syria to the north falls under a different king, Seleucus I. So on the map I provided, I want you to notice where Judea is. It's right on the border between these two great kingdoms. in general, that's not really a good place to be. Because when they go at it, it's going to be in your backyard. So what was life like under the Ptolemies? Well, Ptolemy followed the Persian administration's ideas of religious tolerance. They actually preferred non-natives as government officials. So many Jews in Egypt actually were in a governmental office. They were also allowed limited independence in Judea with local ethnic rulers. Select priestly families continued to rule locally, most notably the Zadokite family. They were a high priestly family. The Jews also were politically well enough connected to take part in some of the political intrigues of the Ptolemaic dynasty changes. So they were kind of in there in a Game of Thrones kind of way, if you will. Jews did have some status as a political identity. If you were considered Greek, meaning you were Hellenized, you were automatically considered a citizen and had the most amount of political rights and freedoms. Jews may or may not be citizens. It depended on your social status. Did you work in the government or another important job? And what kind of education did you have? The local people, the local Egyptians, were not considered citizens at all. They were the manual laborers, if you will, of the society, the whitest part of society, helping the elites keep things going. Also under the Ptolemies, there were specifically Jewish armies. So they trusted the Jews enough in order to let them form their own armies. Also, Jewish festivals were officially recognized under the Ptolemies. So the Sabbath, the Feast of Tabernacles, Passover, it was okay, according to the government, to shut down your market stall. You could take the day off and celebrate these different festivals. Now, also during this period, the diaspora community gains importance. The diaspora is the name of what we call Jews living outside of Judea. They lived outside of Judea for many different reasons, because maybe they had become slaves, trade maybe had taken them there, maybe they were displaced by different wars. But by this time, there is a large group outside. Alexandria became a major home for Jews in the diaspora. We know more about this Alexandrian community than any other group because they made huge literary contributions. There were many, many writers. You see a flourishing upper class in Alexandria. This is also where the Septuagint was translated in the mid-3rd century BCE. However, just like under the Persians, tensions arose around ethnic identity. There were some Jews who chose to forego their Jewish identity, maybe for social, for economic, or political reasons, and they wouldn't have been considered Jewish in any major sense. We have an example in the writings of Artapenes of how this type of person saw the world. They really wanted to build a bridge between Judaism and Greek Hellenism. Here's one way that Artapenes describes the bridge. He's speaking of Moses, who is, of course, a big figure within Judaism. But he interprets Moses in, let's just say, a slightly different way than the way he's portrayed in the Old Testament. Here's what he says. As a grown man, he was called Musaeus by the Greeks. This Musaeus was a teacher of Orpheus. As a grown man, he bestowed many useful benefits on mankind, For he invented boats and devices for stone construction, and the Egyptian arms, and the implements for drawing water and for warfare and philosophy. Further, he appointed for each of the gnomes the god to be worshipped, and for the priests the sacred letters, and that they should be cats and dogs and ibises. On account of these things, then, Moses was loved by the masses, and was deemed worthy of godlike honor by the priests, and called Hermes, on account of the interpretation of the sacred letters. So Artaphanus here frames his portrayal of Moses as being that he is so Hellenistic that he actually created Egyptian religion and was worshipped as the Greek god Hermes. That is definitely a very extreme example of bridging Hellenism and Judaism. Other Jews tried to find other ways. Many Jews became Hellenistic in culture, but retained some sense of ethnic identity. So they might take Greek names, they would speak Greek in the marketplace, but they would continue to worship at the synagogue, and they'd keep the customs of the fathers in some way. There was also groups that believed there should be no mixing between Hellenism and Judaism. So there was a cultural antagonism there. The book of 3 Maccabees is a good example of this. The whole book is really focused on demonstrating that Gentiles are not good worshipers. They're impious. It even tells the story of Emperor Ptolemy V, who was a Ptolemaic emperor in Egypt, how he tried to murder some Jews over their refusal to let him enter the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem. Now, this cultural antagonism wasn't just unidirectional. There were also Gentiles who took issue with the customs of the Jews. They didn't see them as being good Hellenists, and so therefore they were sort of not being patriotic in a sense. So here's where seeds are being sown during this period for later conflict. And we'll see those later conflicts in the first century BCE and first century CE. So the Ptolemaic dynasty continues for about 100 years, but it begins to lose steam and they begin to get weaker. About this time, Judea is taken from them by the Seleucid kings of Syria. Antiochus the Great defeats the Egyptians in 204 BCE and is now in control. Well, Antiochus and his son, Antiochus Epiphanes, wanted to increase the effect of Hellenism. And we'll talk why that is. So this created a division in Judea. Some wanted to give up the customs of the fathers in favor of Hellenism, and some obviously did not, because that's what they believed marked them as Jews. 1 Maccabees tells us about this. It says, "In those days, certain renegades came out from Israel and misled many, saying, 'Let us go make a covenant with the Gentiles around us. For since we have separated from them, many disasters have come upon us.' This proposal pleased them, and some of the people eagerly went to the king, who authorized them to observe the ordinances of the Gentiles. So they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, according to Gentile custom, and removed the marks of circumcision, and abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles, and sold themselves to do evil." So I guess my question for you to think about is, why would someone choose to repudiate their religious or ethnic identity? Now, as we discussed, Antiochus Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus the Great, wanted to encourage his subjects to give up their ancestral religions and customs in favor of Hellenism. He wanted to create a cultural buffer with Egypt and increase the loyalty of his subjects. But he also wanted to defeat Egypt and show that he was an even greater conqueror than his father. So in 168 BCE, he attacked Egypt. He did defeat them, but he was warned by the Romans not to annex it because the Romans wanted it for themselves. So Antiochus defeats them and then leaves. During this period, when he went to Egypt, some people in Judea heard he was killed. So they started to take actions that Antiochus didn't like. And there were many actions that Antiochus had taken that alienated the Judeans. For example, he plundered the temple for gold and levied high taxes to pay off the Romans. He tore down the walls of Jerusalem and installed troops in the city. He appointed high priests to the temple by bribe. And he actually was the first to appoint a high priest that did not come from a high priestly family. Remember, in the Old Testament, only certain families could be high priests. He also installed Greek customs and buildings in Jerusalem. So, Antiochus attacks and defeats Egypt, and he hears that some of the people in Judea had deposed the high priest that he had put in place. So he comes back and takes revenge on them. And 1 Maccabees tells us about that. It says, after subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the sanctuary and took the golden altar, the lampstand for light, all its utensils. He took also the table for the bread of the presence, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crowns, and the gold decoration on the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures he found. So Antiochus at this point basically had given up on the carrot and decides, I'm going to use a stick to make them accept Hellenism and give up their Jewish identity and their Jewish heritage and customs. This, of course, was not very popular with many people. Basically at this point, Hellenism and Judaism really become polarized, and both sides are seen as mutually exclusive. You could not be Jewish and be a Hellenist in Judea, neither could you be a Hellenist and be Jewish. So, Antiochus sends out a decree. 1 Maccabees says, then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that all should give up their particular customs. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. He added, and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. So he sends his troops all around Judea to force people to sacrifice to Hellenistic Greek gods. And he comes to a town, and there is an elderly priest there by the name of Mattathias. And he objects in front of the entire town, in front of the king's troops who are there to force them to do it. First Maccabees says, Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, I and my son and my brothers will continue to live by the covenant of my ancestors. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. So as he is saying this, another Jew comes up to sacrifice to the Greek god. Mattathias comes forward, and 1 Maccabees says, he burned with zeal and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to his righteous anger. He ran and killed him on the altar. He then kills the troops and the captain of the troops for the king. Then Mattathias cried out in the town with a loud voice, saying, let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me. Then he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in town. And this is the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. This one lower priestly family leads a group of rebels out into the desert to overthrow their Syrian overlords. And for many years, they fought against them until finally, about 3 years later, Mattathias' son, Judah, successfully captures Jerusalem and the temple. So Judah decides, we're going to reinstate the sacrifices and the customs of our ancestors. And 1 Maccabees tells it this way. Judas chose blameless priests devoted to the law, and they cleansed the sanctuary and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. At the very season and on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it, it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and joyfully offered burnt offerings. They offered a sacrifice of well-being and a thanksgiving offering. This is the beginning of the festival of Hanukkah. So this priestly family becomes the de facto leaders of this rebellion and founds a dynasty which we call the Hasmonean dynasty because the name of their family was descended from a certain figure named Hasmon. So, what are our takeaways from our time today? Let me suggest a couple things. First of all, multiple foreign rulers challenged the pre-exilic Hebrew conception of what it meant to be the people of Yahweh. Before the exile, being the people of Yahweh meant enforcing certain worship rules throughout the land and supporting the national tribal deity and the kingship, the monarchy. However, after the exile, it was limited to just the Jewish people. Now, they would argue that these other gods, the Greek gods and such, were bad, they were false. But since they were not in control politically, their objectives for society were more limited. Our second takeaway is realizing that groups begin to emerge with different strategies of how to live in a Gentile world. You had certain groups, slaves, soldiers, merchants selling fruit in the marketplace. Well, they had to figure out, how do I live and relate to the Gentiles and their ideas? Some people chose to assimilate completely. Some didn't. And we'll talk more about that in sessions 3 and 4. Our last takeaway is that the choice of some rulers to take a more aggressive stance in enforcing different cultural values created a defensive posture with some Jewish groups. It created a perception that Hellenism and Judaism were incompatible, and it led to outright armed conflicts with major repercussions. And I'm not just talking about the Maccabean revolt. We will see other examples in our other discussions. This aggressive reaction occurred throughout the intertestamental period, all over the Mediterranean basin. So we've come to the end of our time together today. I hope this has been beneficial for you. I appreciate you listening, and I look forward to hearing from you. I have included my contact information on the last slide here, and I would, I hope that this has been a blessing to you. I wish grace and blessing to you and your families. I'll talk to you next time.